extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, the one, the only, the illustrious Matt Doyle. Coming up on today's show, a Match Day 8 recap for you. The best thing that we saw, have to wait to find out. Our man of the match day, is it Dante Van Zier, an assist leader in Major League Soccer, or Frankie Amaya, who turned booze into a game-winning goal? The Red Bulls can play, and FC Cincinnati are looking for some answers. Plus, controversy in Columbus. Cucho misses two games, then gets a violent conduct red card. What's going to happen in the summer? And what happened in El Tráfico? Was it a penalty or was it not? We will give you our answer on that one, as well as our top five teams in Major League Soccer. Go through an absolute bumper crop of whackness around Major League Soccer and preview the CONCACAF Champions Cup. Plus, some incredible mail in the mailbag. Doyle, what's up? How's it going? How you feeling? Can I make you a promise? It's been a tough month here on Extra Time, but I promise, I double down on that promise that this is going to be a good show. I am feeling it on this Monday morning.
Now, if at the end it's a good show and you're asked whether or not it's a good show, are you going to say, yeah, I made that promise, or are you going to back off?
I'm sticking to the promise. I'm not apologizing. All the other MLS podcasts anywhere else in the world, hear me now. We are the top dogs. We are going to have the best Monday recap show in all the land. We are not backing down. Should be a good show. What's the best thing you saw for Major League Soccer this weekend?
Coco Carrasquilla. It was kind of, it ended up being a nothing play, but 40 minutes into what eventually turned into a 2-1 loss for the Dynamo at Chicago. There's a cross from Chicago from the right side cleared just to like the corner of the box, and Coco takes it down, takes two extra touches, now like dribbling towards the corner flag, draws in a couple of Chicago defenders, and then plays a back heel through them directly to Jan Gregis's feet to start what honestly what should have been a transition opportunity. And it was like everything that is beautiful about watching Coco in this league, and makes me happy that the Dynamo have been able to sign him to a long-term deal and keep him here, hopefully for another couple of years. And everything that is just so heartbreaking about the Dynamo right now, because it was Jan Gregg who said the end of that and not Hector Herrera, and the wingers that they had on the field weren't really stretching the field, and they're still playing Amin Bassi, who's their 10, as a false nine. And it's just, it was the entirety of the Houston Dynamo experience this year in one little gorgeous bit of play. Though hats off to the Fire, like even with all the absences, the Dynamo are very good at controlling games and very tough to beat. They had another passing sequence in this one that was like Barcelona-esque, and it ended up with a shot from the left side of the box that was pretty good. Even with all that, Chicago were able to actually get another win. This time it was Jordan Shaqiri with a ball over the top for Brian Gutierrez, who had been a second half sub because he was terrible last week. And so they started him this week on the bench, and he beat Steve Clark to it. And it was a brave finish. I'm not going to say Fire winning 2-1 was the best thing I saw, but you like to see the skill players show up and get it done in the final third. So that ended up being a pretty good game, Wavy.
Hey, that's the Shaqiri that Chicago fans have been begging to see for a long, long time. We'll see if that Shaqiri
and have never seen
show up.
Have never seen hit that version of him for 2 weeks in a row.
Yes.
That's just like, remember the Charlotte game last year after the Miami game? Like, the Miami game was probably Jordan Shaqiri's best game as an MLS player. And then this is in the playoff run last year. And for 60,000 people, they win, 4-0 over Miami. And then they have a Charlotte team at home with just as many, playoff implications. And Charlotte were not good on the road last year. And Chicago did not show up, and they lost that game. And it's like, that's Your number 10 is supposed to win you that game. He's supposed to be the best player on the field. He's never done it 2 weeks in a row. So we'll see what happens this weekend.
It's a vintage Fire experience here. Like, for all the positivity and the wonder at Shaqiri and the performance and the win, and hey, Guti lobs the keeper late on to win the game, you still have that little niggling feeling of Erber's giving the ball away in the final third for a Houston Dynamo goal. Like, even when the Fire impress, they always find a way to shoot themselves in the foot. And credit to the Houston Dynamo. They've been very good this year on 10 points without Ace Ace. It is really a surprise that they've had this kind of start, including CONCACAF within that mix.
Yeah.
But what is Franco Escobar doing?
Yeah.
How is he giving up a PK to Rafa Shijos? It's like he's trying to smell the man's cologne. He's trying to get his musk. His nose was buried in his chest as he put two arms all the way around the back on a corner kick, dude. Like,
here's a question. Here's a question I have, right? Like, if you're the referee officiating this game and you see a defender defending, and I'm using air quotes as I use that word, defending an opposing attacker on a corner kick like that, like before the ball's even kicked, before the play even starts, Escobar literally wraps, was it Shijos or was it
Shijos? Shijos. He almost locked his fingers around the back.
Like he it's a bear hug.
It's a human belt.
It's clear, like, he's following him before the ball is even kicked. If you're the referee, do you whistle and say, hey guys,
break it up, stop this,
you know, Franco, that's going to be a foul. If you do that when the ball, you know, as soon as that happens, I'm Wilson. Like, do you give that kind of warning or do you just have to let it play out? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either.
It's something we're going to have to hear what Pancho Rich has to say, because I'm curious to know, because like, look, there's bumping. There's on every single corner kick, there are a lot of things that can be called a foul. But this is like 100 times out of 100, you have to call this. It is the most brain dead foul I have seen in MLS this season.
And that is saying a lot, because there have been some absolutely mind boggling moments, a bunch of second yellows this weekend as well, where you're just saying, wait, why? In what way could that decision making process go through your head and on the outside turn into that decision? I will also say, just for Franco Escobar or anybody else, like, there's got to be an internal clock here on holding someone in the penalty area, because you're right, there's bumping, there's grinding, all sorts of things happening in there. One Mississippi, two Mississippi. You probably get two Mississippi. Then you got to let go. Didn't happen.
Bumping. And there's grinding, but there's not bumping and grinding.
That's true. Yeah, I just had to get that reference. Right, yeah. Best enough. Thing I saw, Haider Obrion. He is a premature celebrator. He cannot help himself. Last week, he scores a goal. The green lights are going. And when the green lights go off in Austin and you're a home player and you scored, I understand. You lose your mind just a little bit. Against Dallas, goal gets called back. And everybody in the stadium knows, except for poor Haider and Omar Gonzalez, a substitute for the other team, has to come tell him, hey, stop celebrating. This goal is not standing. And then this week, Obrion scores again, but there's a foul in the buildup, which video review catches. But Obrion did not stop his celebration yet again. He literally went to the stands and, I assume, grabbed his own child, a baby, with the name Papa on its back in green sequins, lifted that baby up like Lion King, Simba, high in the air. He was Mufasa and paraded this baby around only for the goal to be called off. And then he got his goal anyway later on in a 4-3 win. I couldn't believe it happened with Omar Gonzalez. That was delightful enough for me. And then to have it doubled down to a baby on the field plucked from the stand celebration that was then called off, as a dad, as a father, I feel terrible for Haider Obrion. He had that planned. It was a special moment for him. I hope he still cherishes that in deep inside of him, that he got to take his baby on the field, even if that goal did not stand.
He then scored later in the game.
Yes.
And his celebration was much more muted. He was not going to fall for it again. It was not going to be three in a row.
No. Look, in that rule in the box, one Mississippi, two Mississippi. Haider, let's apply that to you after you score goals. give it a good 5-10 seconds. Get your eye on the referee, you know, like make sure, like read the body language around you. Try to, if people are arguing, if the other team is saying that's a foul or he's offside.
Wait a minute. I can't believe you're giving him this advice. Because you would 100% go straight to Cam and Wyatt and hoist them both in the air. Come on.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'm just, when it happens twice, you know, third time's the, don't let that be the charm. All right. A little bit more serious now. Extra time's man of the match day. A very important and official award in our minds, perhaps not the rest of the world. Congratulations, either Dante Van Zier Doyle, who had an assist and a goal, his first goal of the season in the Red Bulls 2-1 win in Cincinnati, or Frankie Amaya, who, number one overall draft pick of FC Cincinnati back in the day, endured some tough times, maybe did not leave in a way that made Cincinnati faithful feel warm and fuzzy inside, and therefore was booed quite often in this match and scored a wonderful goal after winning the ball back and bossed the match as a number six. Sandra Schwartz was extremely complimentary. Who's your man of the match day? Take your pick, Dante or Frankie?
It's Frankie. No slight of Van Zier, who has been really good this year and scored a nice goal, though I think Evan Lauro probably wishes he had done a little bit better on that. The Cruyff to shed two defenders in the box, and then it was very picturesque. It was really well done. But to me, the ability that Amaya has always had to sort of blend this like super technical approach with the ball and the bulldog mentality to be a ball winner. I mean, how many times have I said he could be Ozzy Alonso? Like on this show, I've written it in my column. I've said it anytime somebody shoves a mic in my face, and it feels like it's happening. And it's been really pretty far down the list of things people talk about just because defensive midfielders by their nature don't produce a lot of highlights. But if you watch the game, especially a game like this, which was, I think, played at something close to a playoff intensity level, that like Amaya really stands out more and more and more. And this was a landmark win. The Red Bulls went to Cincinnati, who eliminated them in last year's playoffs, who are unbeaten, who are, you know, last year's Supporters Shield winners champions, and were leading, I think, the Supporters Shield race going into this game. And they come out with a 2-1 win. And I thought Lucho Acosta was pretty quiet. And more to the point, I thought that Amaya outplayed head-to-head the Cincinnati deep-lying defensive midfielders.
He and Peter Stroud, by the way. Let's include the play of Peter Stroud as of late. I mean, Obinna Nwodo is into this match, and he's still recovering from injury and is maybe not quote-unquote 90 minutes fit, but Pat Noonan has so many good things to say about his mentality and his ability to push through. But it was Nwodo that lost the ball to Amaya on that goal. And it was, for me, that's sort of the, when you say Ozzy Alonso, that's the distillation of that comparison, right? Because Amaya wins the ball. He wins the physical battle. But then he starts this very quick and intricate and very just spot-on combination play around the top of the box and then is able to finish himself. Now, look, Ozzy wasn't always that guy that was going to finish the play, but he was always the guy that was going to win the ball and start that play. And you know, to me, that's the new Red Bulls, right?
Yep.
Still have Absolutely. The old brand. They can still punch you in the mouth, still press you in the right positions, even if they're not going to do it for 90 minutes in an unrelenting way. But now they have this other way of playing where when they get on the ball, it's not just, hey, shove it down their throat, win a second ball. You got Emil Forsberg. You got Lewis Morgan on the field. Van Zier clearly this year in combination play is probably the best center forward in MLS, maybe not named Luis Suarez. This is a different team that Schwartz is putting out there, and they're fun to watch, which is not something that I said very often for a lot of years.
Yeah. No, it was murder ball. Like last year especially, and this is no slight to Troy Lesane, who's doing amazing work with DC United this year, but it was like none of the technical stuff, the patience that has started to define this group was there last year. It just wasn't. And Amaya is a big, you know, it benefits Amaya greatly, I think, because while he is a bulldog, he's a soccer player, man. He wants to get on the ball. He wants to connect passes. And we've seen that. To your point about Stroud, do we know I didn't see if there was any explanation for why Stroud got the start ahead of Edelman, also in the deep-lying central midfield. Just for those who don't know, Stroud was a homegrown signing ahead of last year for the Red Bulls. And I remember when we were doing the super draft, our good friend Devin Kerr, who's, you know, as up-to-date on everything in college soccer as anyone could possibly be, he said, hands down, Stroud was the best player in college soccer, called him a generational talent, which felt strong, but okay. He had had a couple beers at that point. I let it go, but I haven't forgotten it. He has looked really, really good this year, sort of flitting between central midfield and right wing in that, or right midfield, really, in that 4-2-2-2 the Red Bulls play. Did we see anything from Central Schwartz explaining why Stroud is now starting ahead of Edelman?
I mean, I think it came down to Edelman being suspended. You know, he got that second yellow against the Crew, and then wasn't available against Miami. Then it was a beatdown for the Red Bulls in that one. And I talked to Sandro last week, was on a call with him, and he basically just said, he's playing so well, we don't want to take him out. Like, there's a good continuity between these two players. The amount of ground that he can cover, but the combination of aggressiveness and just cleanness on the ball and ability there really can change the game for us. So this is a good thing for the Red Bulls.
It's also a first world problem, right? And it's Edelman is a fantastic young player. Yeah. He's an incredible ball winner, has an incredible engine. He is absolutely fearless in the challenge. He's a little more limited with the ball than Stroud is. And the fact that Schwartz is making these decisions based in part on who's cleaner with the ball, that's something that we haven't seen from a Red Bulls team in a long time.
Yeah, I want to say about Sandro Schwartz that I didn't know anything about the guy other than just sort of the resume, the CV, as they say, when he arrived in Major League Soccer. But you think German manager, and you often admit this is stereotypical, but so sue me. You often think maybe a little bit more dour, a little serious. He is not that at all. In every conversation I've had with him, and I probably had been on three or four of his calls this year so far, he is jovial. He is laughing. He is positive. He is just like good vibes only type of dude. I am so curious to see where this Red Bulls team can go with just a little bit of a different vision. And then, look, let's be honest. Most importantly, better attacking talent. Like, no offense, like, to Troy Lesane, like, we shouldn't throw him under any bus here. He did not have Emil Forsberg or Lewis Morgan last year. He didn't have the guys that can turn you from a quote-unquote murder ball team into a team that can be patient and incisive and different with the ball. MLS Gone Wild hit us with a stat here, said Red Bulls are actually averaging less possession right now, but they're improving their passes per sequence, and it's almost a full pass per sequence better. And there's a wider trend within MLS that I think we're seeing, and not just MLS, but soccer in general, in the sense that, like, hey, possession cool, but penetration better. So choose your moments. In those moments, do more with the ball. Yes, be direct at times, which the Red Bulls were. I mean, Emil Forsberg is not like dinking it around before he hits that pass to Van Zier. But clearly the Red Bulls have a better feel for when to put their foot on the ball and when to possess a little bit to be incisive than they have in the past, where it was like, hey, pull the hammer out and start pounding nails, boys, because we're going straight to goal. Straight to goal. Anything about Cincinnati stand out to you in this game? I mean, 12 points coming in and had sort of maybe overperformed results-wise, some of their performances, certainly on the attacking side, but I might also argue defensively. Like, what would you take away from this game for them?
I mean, they're still second or third gear. You know, it's not all clicking for them, which is to be expected. We've said it a million times on this show. They lost 5 starters from last year, and they brought in Corey Baird to replace Brandon Vasquez. Corey Baird hasn't really fit. We saw him starting up top alongside Pupenza in the 3-4 1-2, and then a couple weeks ago, Pat Noonan kind of changed the shape a little bit and made it a 3-4-2-1, and didn't really work there either. So now Yuya Kubo, who has started at right wing back, left wing back, number 8, number 10, and now second forward. So Yuya Kubo he's a handyman. He's a utility man. You put him anywhere on the field, he's now the starting forward alongside Pupenza, at least for this week. That's not great. They have work to do. The transfer window is still open for 2 more weeks. I'm curious to see if they can push something across the line here. I know they have interest in Kevin Kelsey, who's a 19-year-old Venezuelan international, plays for Shakhtar Donetsk. And he's cut from the same mold as Brandon Vazquez. He's like 6'2", 6'3", really good movement, really pretty athletic, but like a target forward. You know, like he's not looking to square up and take guys off the dribble. He's looking to combine body of center back and, you know, finish chances with one touch in the box. And I think giving Bupenza that type of guy to play off of, whether it's Kelsey or not, it just makes a lot of sense given what we've seen so far this year. But long term, I don't have any real worries about Cincinnati, Weeby, because of the point you made, the defense, right? Like they invested heavily in their defense over the past couple of years, and they're not going to give up two goals at home very often. And they have enough match winners in attack to keep it in second, third gear, and still hang around in the shield race, because it's not like anybody else is running away with it.
Yeah. The one thing I would say on the defensive side from this match, and maybe it's a wider trend as well throughout the season, is that there's too many situations still, I think, for Pat Noonan's liking, where they're defending in the box in sort of like one-on-one high leverage situations. You know, the hope, if you're any defensive team, is that you're just not allowing box entries at all. You know, Keep the ball out of the area where the other team is more likely to score, and you're going to be fine. Like, and then we saw in this game moments where it just didn't work out for them. Matt Miazga with a crazy grab and pull for a penalty that Lewis Morgan misses, but, you know, and credit to Evan Lauro, it's not a miss. Lauro saves it, and we probably buried that story. 28-year-old former Red Bulls homegrown starts for FC Cincinnati in his first ever MLS start ever as 7 years as a pro. Congratulations to Lauro on that save. But then, you know, Miazga makes the mistake, which they hadn't made before. Yedlin and Robinson, to your point about the cutback, just get left in the dust, and then Lauro probably should be doing better. So I'm curious to see how they do without Roman Celentano in net, who has that high ankle sprain. They'd like to get him back as soon as possible, and how they continue to try to prevent entries into the box. The thing I would say about the number nine is it's not just with the ball for Cincinnati. I'd argue it's almost as important without the ball. You know, one thing Corey Baird's been doing well is he understood the pressing scheme quickly. Like, he got it. But there's a difference between having Brandon Vazquez up top, applying pressure, routing the ball into the areas where you want to win it, and then being the outlet once you win it to bounce off of him into Lucho, than any of the players they have right now. Like, Bupenza needs that presence. He needs that guy in the team. I still don't think they've gotten nearly enough out of him, and I wouldn't necessarily put that on Cincinnati. I'd put that more on the player right now than his price tag dictated. So there are some things to work on in Cincinnati, but clearly they got a super high ceiling and they've got a runway in front of them to get these players integrated and push them forward. So, all right, that was a good match. That was a wonderful one to watch. El Tráfico was not as explosive as it's often been. 4.3 goals average all time. That average is going to come down just a tad because we only got 3 goals in this game and really should have only had 2 goals. Should we start with the game winner, Denny Bouanga, Mickey Yamane, the penalty decision by John Freeman?
Please.
Then to the monitor, and John Freeman sticks with his call. I was flabbergasted that he stuck with that call. To me, this is just clear simulation and embellishment by Bouanga, and I'm not going to be one of those people that points my finger at him and says, how could he? This is a professional game where results are the number one thing. Players are going to try to get advantages, but in the age of video review, I would like to see that 10 out of 10 times reversed and the penalty taken off. No way for me that is a penalty. I mean, you see Bouanga toe tap and drag his right foot before there's ever any possibility of contact from Yamane, who, you know, to call a spade should not go down, right? Mm-hmm. Should not be going down and sliding in this situation, but does not initiate the contact. And Bouanga throws the right leg out into him to create, I think, contact. I don't actually see it on any of the replays. It's not a smoking gun for me in that sense. And then I'm just so shocked that Freeman did not reverse the decision after being sent to the monitor.
Yeah, if he's sent to the monitor, then it's indicative of the video assistant referee literally saying, hey, I think this is a wrong call. Is that correct?
Yeah, clearly and obviously this is the incorrect call. That's the only way that Freeman gets taken to the monitor. And now look, it is human. There is a person saying that. So it's not universal, and referees obviously have the ability to go and say, no, I'm going to stick with my call on the field. I disagree. I respect that. That's the way it should be. I just don't see the case for that in this situation.
It's like calling a moving screen when there's 6 seconds left in a Final Four game when you've been letting those go all night. Just doesn't make much sense.
I don't think it's quite like that, but I appreciate your callback. It was a wonderful weekend of women's college basketball. Loved both those games. Was frustrated by that call. So I wanted to see it. Yeah,
I didn't love that first game quite as much.
Yeah, yeah. UConn fans have a little different perspective on this one. Did the rivalry live up to you outside of this controversy, which I think let's just leave that behind and talk to soccer?
So it lived up in a different way. It felt like these were two good teams who know who they are going at it and fighting real hard for a result. It didn't live up in the typical El Tráfico way, which is six goals and, you know, insanity all over the pitch and more about star power and ridiculousness than soccer. This felt like a good soccer game. It also felt like we saw the flaws with both teams. The Galaxy are like, they're not a complete team because they can't defend set pieces. I think they've given up five or six already this year.
Six.
It's absurd.
It's great.
No matter how good they are with the ball, no matter how elite Ricky is, and I didn't think he was great today because I thought he was dropping too deep, or great this weekend because I thought he was dropping too deep. Like, you're not a real contending team unless you fix it. You have to fix that. You have to fix that. And with LAFC, they got gifted the game winner, and then they, even though they start a central midfielder at center forward, which usually gives you more of the ball, they're not able to create any rhythm or dominance through midfield. So they always leave the door open because they're always up against it. Nonetheless, both teams are organized enough and dangerous enough where they're going to, like, these are two playoff teams, but there's just like pieces missing. And so I enjoyed the game, and I thought it was a good game from that perspective. It wasn't a super memorable El Tráfico in any other way other than the missed call.
Yeah, I buy that. I think for LAFC, I mean, just look at the benches. Look at the options. Look at the starting lineups. Like, they need to do some business here. And it's not just two open DP spots, one of which we assume, based on our boy Tom Bogert and others, that will be Olivier Giroud. Like, I think there's a lack of depth in this team, more so across the board. Now, they were hurt by David Martinez getting that silly red card. He's not available. So all you have off the bench to change the game is really Kai Kamara or Daz, if it needed to be an attacking piece that changed the game and not just holding on to a lead. So to me, this is still a very incomplete LAFC team. I would expect their summer transfer window to be quite busy.
They haven't hit on most of their young signings over the last couple of years, though. And that has to be the concern, right?
Let's go through them. So we got Bogush. I'd say middling probably, but not up to the levels that you would expect based on the price tag and his reputation.
Oliveira, same thing.
Yeah, same thing. He has, it's like, you know, the old Darlington Nagbe meme? Where it's like world class between the 18s, and then you get into the 18, and you're like, uh-oh, this is not going the way we expected based on the rest of the field. Probably unfair to Darlington in some ways, but I don't think unfair right now for Oliveira. Who else we got in that bucket?
Stipe Biuk.
Yeah, that one for sure.
Right. It's similar to what we saw with the Darlington meme. Is that like I thought he was really good until he got in and around the box, and then he was less good.
Brian Rodriguez, would you count that one?
Oh, that was a different time, right? That was a different that was Bob's decision. Philip Krastev, the Bulgarian kid who they brought in for a loan last year, and then it was supposed to run through the middle of this year, and they were like, no, don't even bother coming back. Who else? Mario Gonzalez, not a kid, but like, it, you know, he was supposed to help, and he obviously did not. Like, that is not a great hit rate on signings.
And Campos didn't start this match as well.
That's a good point, but I think it's too early.
Good.
Yeah, he's looked more good than bad. I think back to the winter of 21-22 when they built the roster that won the double that year and largely was kept intact to make it to three finals last year. Everybody remembers the Gareth Bale signing because he had that one big moment and it was the biggest of moments. But the transfer window work that really turned LAFC into a two-year juggernaut was done within MLS. It was when they went out and got Ryan Hollingshead and Kellen Acosta and Maxime Crepeau, guys who have Ilya Sanchez, guys who have a long history of winning and understanding how to win in MLS. That was the core of these two teams. And they've really lost a lot of that in the subsequent years, and they're kind of stitching together a group of guys who don't have that institutional know-how within the league. And I think they've gotten worse, frankly. I think if you look at LAFC now compared to the same group 2 years ago, there are probably bigger names now and more interesting players in terms of long-term future, but they're not as good a team as they were 24 months ago. And given the hit rate on these interesting young players they're bringing in, I would be a little bit concerned if I was an LAFC fan.
It goes two ways, right? It's the top end talent, but it's also very clearly depth. I'm going to take you through this roster that won the 2022 MLS Cup and compare it to what we saw on Saturday, just in terms of depth and quality. So 2022, Bawanga, Chicho Arango, and Carlos Vela up top. I mean, that's incomparable.
Like in retrospect, they should have ended up on 80 points and won MLS Cup 4-0. My God.
So Kellen Acosta, Ilya Sanchez, and Jose Cifuentes in central midfield. Back line, Chiqui Palacios, Ibiaga, Murillo, and Hollingshead, and then Crepeau in goal. But listen to this bench. Franco Escobar, our snuggly boy, Eddie Segura, Giorgio Chiellini, Latif Blessing, Sebas Mendez, Gareth Bale, Kwadwo Opoku, and Christian Teo. Here's the bench from Saturday. Kai, Segura, Dueñas, Ordaz, Chanot, Romero, Campos, Tomas Angel, and then Luis Muller. That is not even comparable.
Yeah.
It's different universes. And that's why I say this summer is so huge for them. They need quality and they need depth. And they're still competing. So credit to Steve Cherundolo in that sense. Like, he is doing it in a very pragmatic way. Extremely pragmatic.
Yeah.
But I don't think you look at these performances right now and say, at least for me, you know, I'm sure others will disagree that, like, hey, Steve, this is the issue. I think they need more players and better players.
I agree across the board.
Anyway, for the Galaxy, it was a tough one. Speaking of more and better, center back remains an issue for them. I think you mentioned it. Edwin Cerrillo starts at center back because they're going all the way down the depth chart. There are they did sign a new center back out of Colombia, a younger guy that I think from a physical perspective has a different profile in the sense that he's very good 1v1 based on his tape and good in the open field, which is not necessarily something that they have a ton of, given the age profile of some of their center backs. But yeah, this was not a vintage performance for them in any way. You got to solve the set pieces. You got to find a better way to get those wingers involved. Because I thought this was the least impactful game that we saw from Pansil for sure. And, you know, Peck is still working his way in. But despite the loss, despite the fact that they had a measuring stick moment that they didn't quite live up to, and most away teams in this rivalry don't, it's just three away wins in 22 matches overall, I am struck by the difference, to play on the same theme we just did with LAFC, a year makes for this Galaxy team. Think back to last year. There were literal protests by the fans calling for basically the clear out of the front office. Like, the fans were, and they got it. And the different players, different results, different, a lot of things, to this Saturday where the Galaxy organization spent $100,000 to bring 1,000 fans to BMO. Imagine that happening last year. Imagine those fans being so juiced about their team and their prospects and their new signings that they would happily work with the front office in that way. It was just impossible to imagine. And as we talk about LAFC's need to make moves, credit to Will Kuntz and the Galaxy for making the moves. Like, they didn't wait to do the business. They had the targets, they ponied up the money, and they went out and got the guys that were going to elevate Jovalich, that can elevate Puig. They have issues at center back. They have some injuries. You could argue maybe even at goalkeeper as well. But Will Kuntz went out and made the moves, and I thought it was interesting that Taylor Twellman said on the broadcast that those are two guys that Kuntz had identified at LAFC. Think about Paintsil on the right. Taylor said that that was a potential replacement for Carlos Vela. Think about Paintsil on the right in this LA team.
Yeah.
Woo! Woo! All right. Top five teams in MLS after match day 8. I do not have my power rankings ballot in, but you have put yours in. So give me your top five teams right now in this league where 15 teams have between 14 and 10 points and nobody has more than 4 wins in at least 7 games.
I have Columbus number 1 still.
Still?
Yeah. Just nobody else has looked as good as them in terms of the heights they can hit, and they're juggling a tough schedule with CONCACAF Champions Cup play, and they... they're just really, really good. Miami number 2, and I know that's going to be controversial in some quarters, but they're juggling a really, really tough schedule. They're going to Monterrey midweek with the intention of winning. Like, this team really is out for blood after what happened in the first leg of that CONCACAF Champions Cup.
I'd like to congratulate both you and myself, as well as Anders and all the listeners. It's 35 minutes, and we did not mention Inter Miami, and Messi returned this weekend and scored. So all of your trash talk about how much we care about Inter, into the trash.
Yeah, well, people aren't going to care. They're still going to talk that trash, maybe. But I just think Miami, you know, we've seen them win against good teams this year without Messi. They have obviously taken some dings in terms of their health, but they're getting healthier now. Negri is back. Kramaski is back really soon. Freire makes a huge difference from them when he's good to go, and I think he's going to be starting in Miami, or in Monterrey, rather. But I think these two teams, when we've seen them put the hammer down, they've hit a level I don't think anybody else in the league can match. I have Cincinnati number 3. I know they just lost, but I just have a ton of confidence in them. Red Bulls are 4. And Philly, now that Julian Carranza is back, I have Philly at 5. I could be talked out of that, but nobody else has really made a great case. And I know there's going to be some angry Whitecaps fans. Guys, look at the schedule you've played. Even Vanni Sartini said in his post game that things are about to get harder, right? Like, they have had the softest schedule in the leagues so far. They have done a good job of beating the teams in front of them. I need to see them do it against tough teams on the road before I'm convinced they're a top 5 team. But yeah, you'll notice that it's all teams from the Eastern Conference. It's not a surprise given what we all thought going into the season.
I love that you made the Vancouver point. We'll get to them, and they had a big win against Toronto, but it is wins at San Jose, at Dallas, home against Portland, home against Toronto. Next 5, LA at home, at Seattle, at Red Bulls, Austin at home, that's the easy one, at LAFC. And then you go at Colorado, at Seattle after that, then home against Miami. This is, you know, this is where seasons and sort of la qualita gets shown. Yep. So we'll see about them. How about American Soccer Analysis? Love their goals plus metric. Who are the top 5 there? Just, you know, just for us wonks out there.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, our friends over at American Soccer Analysis, they're all brain scientists and rocket surgeons. They have devised this metric called goals added. And the idea is that every touch, every event on the field is fractionally more or less likely to create a goal for your team or create a goal for, you know, your opponent. And they have done everything from passes to passes received to tackles to interceptions to fouls to dribbles, everything under the sun. They have collected data for years to create this model. And the idea behind it is more data means it's more predictive. It is better in terms of long-term predictability for how good a team is or how bad than simply using the score, because, you know, scoring in soccer is very high variance, you know, vibes, sometimes ball go in, that type of thing. Their model, and it is too a little bit too early in the season, like they say to wait probably 9-10 games before it really becomes predictive. But so far, DC United is the best team in the league. Seattle is number two.
Ooh.
Seattle, yeah, which is a little bit surprising. But then you think about how the games have played out. The Sounders have gotten their chances. Sounders have a ton of the ball in good spots. They just haven't gotten finishing from Rui Diaz and Morris. And then, well, you do that enough, and what happens? You start winning games, and maybe you win one 5-0. Atlanta, number three. Atlanta does a really good job of progressing the ball, getting guys like Saba and John De Silva on the ball in good spots. And of course they have in Yakumakis and Tiare, two center forwards who both have a knack, a gift for finding quality chances from within the 6-yard box. And there's basically nothing more valuable in soccer than that. LAFC are fourth. I was surprised by that. But the model likes LAFC. And if you think about it, Dennis Bouanga has hit the woodwork seven times so far this year.
That's a crazy stat. I looked it up before this weekend. He is like in the goal minus XG leaders, but not in the good way.
Yeah.
He was number one, and Christian Oliveira is in that list as well. So there's a lot of not put ball in back of net, to reference your earlier point.
Variance and vibes, man. And like last year, every one of those seven that he dinged off the woodwork would have been goals. Right. So LAFC are still doing the same things that made them a very good team all of last year, as per the model. And then the Red Bulls are fifth. So the Red Bulls are the only team that we have that I have in my personal top five. And that is also in the model's top five, which I thought was interesting.
Three of those players, I'm at FB Ref right now, just looking at the non-penalty goal minus XG. So you talked about DC, LAFC, and Seattle. Those are three of the top five teams that just aren't finishing. Like are getting into great spots, great opportunities. They're just not finishing right now. Number one on that list is Orlando City, who we will talk about in just a little bit.
Okay. Anders is going all caps in the in the chat. Anders has been saying from day one this year that Bouanga was going to suffer heavy regression to the mean after last year, because he overperformed his underlying numbers massively last year. He's underperforming those numbers by a larger margin so far this year. I think it would be foolish on Anders' part and any other LAFC haters' part to expect Bouanga to keep hitting nothing but woodwork in 2024. I think this gentleman is going to end up on, you know, 13 to 15 goals this season.
All right. By the way, we talked about Philly here just for a second. They won against Nashville. Carranza and Gazdag with the goals still remain unbeaten, the last team in MLS. I just want to shout out Gary Smith, who came out in his press conference after this loss. It's been tough times in Nashville, and said, I think we're at a point where certainly we need to consider what it looks like in the open market to get a body or two in. It could be quite difficult, of course, because the window closes soon, but I will certainly be talking to Mike Jacobs about that next week. Oh, that's interesting. Very, very interesting. All right, let's jump into That's Whack. It was bumped up because the level of whackness. Those are straight quotes from Mr. Anders Aarhus there. Columbus won, DC United won. The whackness is Cucho being sent off after two games out because of team policy. That is a nightmare. Doyle, that is not what you want. You wanted to see him come back if you're a Crew fan and ball out, get some goals, show that he's completely bought in and all about where this team is headed. I'm not sure that his decision says the antithesis of that. It might just be frustration boiling over, one, because of missing two games, including a huge one against Tigres. Also because opposing teams, and DC certainly among them, seem to just be going to the hack-a-crew strategy here. What did you make of Cucho's red card? Violent conduct, I think clearly so, right out of the James Sands school of falling on the ground and kicking both feet into an opponent's legs.
Yeah, it was disappointing. I don't know that it portends or signifies anything worse than a guy, you know, having the red mist descend a little bit after getting fouled in a game that honestly, you know, Columbus was being pushed around. DC was the better team on the field in this game. And I think maybe that was eating at Cucho a little bit. If it was just that, you would say, okay, yeah, this happens. He's a fiery guy. Most forwards are. And you move on. In the context of having just had a 2-game suspension imposed by the coach for, you know, demonstrably being unhappy after getting subbed off against Charlotte. And from what I understand, having talked to folks, you know, close to the team, that's all it was. There was nothing else that led to the 2-game suspension. It was how he reacted to being subbed off against Charlotte. And you know, the immediate aftermath of that, which seems insane to me that you suspend your, like, everybody understands. We were talking with Sasha Kleshtin about this a lot on Saturday night. And Sasha's like, I've been on teams. And remember, Sasha played 35 games in the Champions League. He was on the same team as Romelu Lukaku. Like, he has a lot of experience with this. And Sasha's point was, I've been on teams where there are two sets of rules, one for the superstar and one for everybody else. And to see Wilfred Nancy, would Aiden Morris have gotten suspended 2 games if he threw such a fit after being?
Well, I don't know, but the immediate thought I had after all this, and as you're talking about it, is Santi Rodriguez did a similar thing to Mehdi Bellucci, the New York City FC assistant, and then came back the next game and was playing and scored.
Yeah.
So two different handling
and NYCFC is at the bottom of the standings, and Columbus is at the top. So maybe that.
Yeah, maybe desperation played a role there for the blue side of New York. But yeah, there's just different coaches are going to do it in different ways. And yeah, it's strange. It's strange. Matt Johnson hit us up.
My worry is that I have enjoyed watching Columbus over the past 14 months as much as I have enjoyed watching almost any team in MLS history. And I just don't want the wheels to come off in any conceivable way. I want them to still be this amazing, beautiful, idealistic soccer team. And that's harder for them to be if Cucho's not bought in.
So they play against Tigres in Champions Cup on Tuesday, 8:15 p.m. Eastern time. It's 1-1 right now after the game in Columbus last week. Matt Johnson hit us up and said, is Cucho on the transfer block this summer with the Crew and Nancy? Is it not just the dumb red card, but the applauding after getting sent off, the additional evidence of undiscipline? I can't imagine Nancy is going to tolerate this for very long. What do you think? Could Cucho be on the transfer block? Admittedly, this had not entered my brain, but maybe like you, I've just enjoyed the Crew experience so much that I'm just not willing to consider a future where it doesn't stick around long enough to win multiple trophies additional.
I mean, I'm the same way. I think we've seen in Wilfred Nancy's 3.5 years managing, you know, as head coach in MLS, he's handled basically every situation perfectly. He hasn't had one like this yet. It is going to be really interesting to see. I know that's like the most milquetoast way to put it, but like, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how he handles this, because this team, even without Cucho, they're really good. But Cucho for 6 months was the best player in MLS, man.
Yeah, I think it comes down to that relationship, right? And that is one of the most difficult things about not just managing, I think life, like maintaining relationships, maintaining respect and admiration and love through different parts of your life and different parts of your, in this case, career. Like Cucho's 24. You know, he came from Watford and he's balled out, but you have to imagine there's some part of his brain, despite being called into the Colombian national team while with the Crew, that still considers like Europe a place he wants to be. Yeah, maybe, and money can change those things, and certainly success can change those things as well. But like, his relationship with Wilfred has to be paramount for the Crew, for Wilfred, for Cucho. I mean, these are the things that keep star players happy and engaged and productive. And I have faith in Wilfred. He's, as you said, not really put a foot wrong. He seems like the sort that is extremely considerate of all the interpersonal things that matter when it comes to a player's performance. And now we just wait and see, right? It's just time. It's time, and our first opportunity to wait and see is Tuesday, and you have to imagine Cucho is going to be starting and extremely motivated because he will not be playing at the weekend. So Tuesday, Tigres Columbus. No Aiden Morris for that one. Morris had an absolute laser beam pile driver to tie this match for the Crew. They keep showing a little bit of grit and a little bit of toughness to come back, but the results aren't quite there. Tigres is not in the best of form. They've lost 3 out of 5 in Liga MX. I believe their next match is in Estadio BBVA against Monterrey in Liga MX. So they got something to look at the other end, but you know they want to win Champions Cup. And I think more than any other Liga MX team left, they see their opponent as a true threat. Who moves on?
Money's always on Tigres. When MLS teams play the three giants in Liga MX, and that's Tigres, Monterrey, and Club America, you are burning your money if you're choosing anybody but the Liga MX teams. And the difference is, this winter, Columbus knew they were going to be in this competition and knew they had a really good team, and they were able to go out and spend, maybe $2 million on Marino Hinestroza and get Derek Jones as a free agent. Tigres, Monterrey, Club America all went out and spent over $10 million to reinforce their sites. It's just a different, it's a higher stakes table that these teams are still sitting at in terms of salary budget. So even the best MLS teams are at a pretty profound disadvantage against the biggest spending Liga MX teams. And that's just the way it is for now.
Morris is a big loss for the Crew, obviously, but go to the bad form by Tigres. They're balancing something here. They're in seventh place right now. 8 make the playoffs, and it's a wild card spot. Think about that. Tigres into the wild card. Flip side is, think about Tigres in the wild card, make it a run all the way in the Liguilla. Oh, I can see that very, very easily. We'll watch on Tuesday. More to come in CCC. Other headlines here. El Promiso, New England, Charlotte. 1-0. The Revs get the win. Now, Caleb did walk back the promise, and I listened to the clip. It was a sort of a throwaway comment at the end of his radio interview. But when you use the word promise, that is going to get into headlines. It's going to get into the zeitgeist, into all the news. And, of course, on the flip side, Dean Smith responded to it and said, you shouldn't promise things you can't keep. But he kept it. They got the win. They simplified things. They didn't try to ticky-tack their way through Charlotte, went direct at times, and got the dub. Now, Doyle, I would argue that New England got a little fortunate here. God, I love Patrick Aujimon. He is my he's my dude. We just need a finish, Patrick. We need one finish, an empty net miss, and then another good opportunity that's blazed over the bar. He is rushing things. He's just not composed enough and technical enough in those final moments to be super productive, but nobody is for Charlotte right now. What's your big takeaway?
My big takeaway just from that is trust forwards who find chances to eventually start putting those chances away. And the fact that Aujimon is in his second year as a pro and is pretty consistently creating danger and sometimes finishing plays off, I think that's a guy you keep running out there. Certainly Enzo Capetti hasn't made a case for himself to be the man. So I'm okay if I'm Charlotte. It's always tough to go on the road and get a result. I thought they did okay. For New England, this is still a team that I don't know who they are. As you made the point that they went a little bit more direct, and that's true. But their best moments of being direct came from when they were actually holding the ball deeper and knocking it around between the back line and the D-mids, pulling Charlotte upfield, and then playing through them and not just blasting it over the top. They're made to do that. But if you look at them when they're on the ball in that back line, the rotations are slow. So the decisions are slow. So they're more prone to turnovers and they're more prone to wayward passes through midfield, which then means they're scrambling to get back, in a numbers down or even situation. And no defense in the world holds out indefinitely for that. And then add on top of it that a lot of the Rev success from 2019 to 2022 or, you know, honestly, through the middle of last year, was based upon having two of the greatest shot stoppers that we have ever seen in this league, Matt Turner and then Georgi Petrovic. Ravas has not been that guy. Earl Edwards is not that guy. It's a massive downgrade at a position that is sort of at the locus of all the value that is created on the field by everything the opponent does. If you're going to have a subpar goalkeeper, you're probably going to have a subpar season.
Another note from this game, Leal Abada made his first start, but Charlotte, again, just outside of Ajimon's chances, really just did not create enough. Just a shot, one chance created, a dribble, 61 minutes. More to come from Leal Abada. I would argue, man, Charlotte need a 10. They tried to get one in the offseason. Let's see if they can get one in the summer. Dean Smith so far has been pretty good about forcing the things through that he wants. We were going to try to predict Caleb Porter's lineup, but, you know, we're 50 minutes in here, and let's just say it's going to be rotated, folks. You lost 4-0 at home to America, who will probably rotate as well. There is zero chance, and I feel confident promising this, there is zero chance that the Revs reverse this. So you need to put your resources and your time and your effort and your energy into MLS, at least the finite ones. Yes, put out a young, hungry team, go for it. But let's be honest about the probability of a result here.
If you're a big Noel Buck or Esmir Bajrak-Terevich fan, midweek at Club America, this is probably your chance to see him go 90.
If you love Ryan Spalding, here we go, baby. This is it for you. We'll see what happens with that one.
Let me ask you this, Weeby, and I know we don't have the time for it, but I'm going to do it anyway.
That's what I would do, so I applaud you.
Do you go, because I think Ravas is still, I mean, he just got a shutout, right? So he's the number one option in goal.
Earl Edwards, come on down. If Ravas is your guy, you don't put him in the shooting gallery.
Okay. That is exactly what I was going to ask.
Yeah, that'd be my opinion on that one. That's not a place to build confidence. It's the short straw, so to speak. Hey, go down to Azteca. What you got? What you got? All right. Sounders 5, CF Montreal 0. Seattle got their first win in this one, ran them off the field. No surprise there. Montreal has a very difficult start to the season, which they've been positive. It's been a good start for them, but to go all the way across the country on dead legs, you could just see it. They just didn't have it. I'm going to ask you this, though, on the Sounders side. Hunter Bruckbauer says, when Pedro de la Vega gets back, should Smetzer drop one of Roldan and Morris and keep Rusnak at the 10 with Atencio as the ball winner in a double pivot? How should they line up at full strength?
I think you drop one of Morris and Rui Diaz. Or you don't put de la Vega immediately into the starting lineup. I think the what makes the Sounders so good is their ability to control the game through midfield. And having Rusnak as the number 10 in front of Atencio and João Paulo, who returned this week and got the final half hour, like, it's Atencio and João Paulo deep in central midfield, as far as I'm concerned. It is Rusnak as the number 10 until or unless De La Vega proves he's better. And the whole purpose of that is twofold. It's okay, you want to have a midfield that can create chances, and that midfield has shown the ability to create chances, not just with Rusnak, who had two assists as your number 10, but also with Atencio's ability to switch the field. He switches the field to play better than anybody else on that roster. And for a team that gets so much out of that right side overload with the Roldans, you want a guy who could switch the field that easily and that accurately. But it's also a defensive measure. The Sounders last year were the best defensive team in MLS because they were up around 60% possession, because they were always able to organize the pieces on the chessboard in a way where they were almost never exposed. And I don't think you necessarily want to throw that away for the sake of getting even a guy who's ostensibly as talented as De La Vega onto the field. So now you have a situation where, somebody good is going to have to sit. And if that's Rui Diaz, if that's Morris, they're just going to have to deal with it. And Brian Schmetzer has done a great job since 2016 in dealing with everything that's been thrown his way. Well, this is another thing that's going to be thrown his way. And he's going to have to figure out how to make it work. And the other, you know, the The other thing here is like neither Morris nor Rui Diaz nor De La Vega have exactly been the pictures of health throughout their respective careers. So I don't think that it's going to be a week after week thing where all three of them are going to be 90 minutes fit. And I expect that health concerns will kind of make the lineup choices for Schmetzer.
Yeah, it's not a set it and forget it type of deal. You would think, but you would hope the opposite, that those guys stay healthy just for our enjoyment of the Seattle Sounders. For Andre's enjoyment of this show, I'm going to ghostwrite a take for him that I know he would agree with. Big game for Cody Baker. Came on in the 11th minute for Nuhu and performed. So you're welcome, Anders, on that one. Miami 2, Colorado 2. Tata rotated big time ahead of that Monterrey game. I mean, all the big guns on the bench. Messi, Suarez, Busquets, Alba, Freire, Gomez, Weigand. All these guys are going to play big roles in Mexico on the bench. They came on at halftime, many of them, including Lionel Messi. He scored. Looked like Miami were going to hold on for a big 3 points at home. But here come the Colorado Rapids. Our guy, Hammer, on Twitter says, how about them Rapids with a sucker punch to steal a point in Miami, even with three of the four stars playing the majority of the second half? Matthew Scheiman says, Doyle's column completely missed the, quote, Rapids youngsters take on the best players in the world and don't choke narrative.
Wait a minute. Are Ryan Saylor and Noah Allen the best players in the world? Because those were the center backs. Okay.
Well, it's David versus Goliath, says Matthew, and David got a point out of it. Talk about that, boys. Cole Bassett, great finish here. Nice, really good counterattack. Georgi Mihailovic with a good slip pass in behind, and then, you know, off and running for the Rapids. It's a good moment for them. It is a infuriating moment, I would think, for Tata Martino in the 87th minute at home in a game you're winning 2-1 to expose yourself in that way. I would think that he would look at that tape and that play and just say that can never, ever happen to this team again. And maybe this is the lesson that they need. But shout out to Leo Alfonso for Miami. Scores a goal, was signed on Tuesday. That's pretty cool. Great experience for that young man. Let's look ahead. Let's look ahead to Monterrey. What do you think? Messi get it done? Miami get it done?
You know, everything that I said about the crew having to get it done against Tigres is applicable here, except it's Lionel Messi, man. It's the greatest player the game's ever seen. It's tough to pick against him in something he wants to win, and he desperately wants to win this. I think we found that out last week after the game, where there were some unpleasantries exchanged between Messi and a couple of the folks from Monterrey. He's going to start, and he's going to be out for blood.
It's a good plan to piss off Lionel Messi before an elimination game. Yeah, I would do that. I would go out of my way to make sure that was a thing that not only happened behind the scenes, but then happened in the public sphere. And I would just keep on talking about it if I was Rayados.
The other thing here is that when Freire has been available, he has elevated this team on both sides of the ball. Because he's just a very good defender, right? He's a very solid defender. But he's also better in distribution than Aviles or Christophe have been. And that gets Miami in a rhythm through midfield. He's been maybe the second most important player on this team, or third, we should consider Suarez too, because Suarez has been unbelievable. But he has been the big difference maker out of that back 4-5. And I think he's going to play. I think he's going to start and go 90 in this one. I'm still picking Monterrey because until an MLS team shows that they're able to consistently beat these elite Liga MX teams, it's just foolish to pick the MLS side. But man, if you're a Miami fan, you're going down there with a healthy and fired up Lionel Messi, you probably like your chances.
We had a conversation on MLS Wrap-Up on Saturday night at the end of the show. And I wish we had 4 hours to have the conversation, because the prompt was basically, has Messi been a success if you take the cups out of it? I mean, I think that's absurd. I think the prompt itself is, I can't.
Ridiculous.
What are we talking about here? The entire point of Lionel Messi is that he wins everything, and he won the thing that he arrived to win, and then he almost won the second thing, and because of injuries and time that he spent in those and effort there, he wasn't able to contribute to the same level you might have expected to go get in the playoffs, which I fully would have expected them to go win again if he was healthy. So, but these are the moments, right? Like, forget the games he's played in the regular season, all that stuff. Wednesday night in Monterey, those are the moments. Those are the Messi moments. Judge him on moments that directly correlate to winning something. That's his legacy in Major League Soccer. So I'm very curious to see the level he has, the level that Tata and Inter Miami are able to put out there, and Monterey's response. This has a ton of delicious narratives going into it, and we will see who comes out.
Just for the record, Messi has 5 goals and 3 assists in about 700 minutes in league play.
I think it's this year, I think it's 4-4 in 4 games.
Yeah. And I was just going with primary assists, but secondary assists, yeah, it jumps up to.
I mean, if he plays, he balls.
Yep.
Right? Like, that, we knew that. But, like, who's surprised that he had to miss a few games after putting every single ounce of gasoline into the tank for Leagues Cup after winning a World Cup, playing a half season in your. Anyway, we'll watch on Wednesday. Vancouver 4-0. How good are the Caps? How bad are Toronto? I'll do the Toronto side, then you can handle Vancouver. Toronto, I mean, that was a mirage to start the season. I feel confident saying that. I felt confident before the season. The start was a little bit encouraging, but unsustainable. Like, look, Lorenzo Insigne can't bang him top corner every single match, especially if he can't play, and he's out for now 5 more weeks or whatever it is. You go through a laundry list of things that a team that's up against it from a talent perspective can't do in games, and Toronto did all of them. Every single one. Set pieces, restarts, recycles of those, not defending counterattacks off their own set pieces. It was shambolic, and John Herdman circled the team on the field afterwards, but culture needs wins. So I'm very curious to see how this team responds after 4 straight L's. Meanwhile, Vanni Sartini is an absolute delight. Brian White is back, and he's scoring goals, and they got 1 loss in 6 matches. Second MLS, 13 points, right in the top end of that big pack we talked about. How good are the Whitecaps?
I think they're very good. I led my column with them yesterday, just delineating the ways that they've been good. And what we saw in this game was Vanni Sartini throwing in a couple of wrinkles. Like the first goal came off Vancouver pressing, and they haven't pressed all year. So they have the ability to hurt you in different ways. And I think they will get through this next like 10-game stretch that you rattled off before. I think they'll be in good shape. I think they are missing at least one piece to be elite. Now,
what's the piece?
I think it's probably a high-end chance creator. And then the question is like, okay, can Pedro Vite be that guy? Can Pedro Vite find 2 more levels to hit? It's not.
How many times have we asked that?
He's 22. He was awesome in CONMEBOL.
He was
Olympic qualifying,
and he was awesome at times last year too.
Yeah. So can he be awesome on a weekly basis this year for Vancouver? If he is, they don't necessarily need to go find that. And by the way, Fafa Picot has been under the radar, one of the best signings this offseason. He has been great as well, giving them a ton of dynamism on both sides of the ball because he's always been such a committed defender in addition to being super dangerous and stretching the field and getting in the box and finishing off plays. So they check a lot of boxes, but we've seen it happen multiple times over the past couple of years. When they come up against the best teams in the region, Tigres, LAFC, they're just out-talented. And the best way to not be out-talented is to go acquire more talent. And they need to do it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But a nice start for the Whitecaps, who historically have not always got off to the best starts. All right, we're back. It's the return of the Mac. There it is, the return of the Mac. Come on, the return of the Whack. Oh, my God, I did not sing that at the level I wanted to. Ben Bear has always sang.
I didn't know that was coming.
Yeah, yeah. I did, but I didn't. Ben Bear, that's an homage to him. He always sang Return of the Mac at any karaoke session we ever had over the years in New York City. We're returning to Whackness. Pick your Whackness here, Doyle. Portland's first half or Sporting Kansas City's second half? I think I gotta go with the home team, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
to be up 3-0,
yeah,
to drop 3-3, that is wild. Like,
they had the chance to go up 4, right? Because they get that penalty kick.
Talk about your boy. Alex Williams says, let Doyle talk about Willie Agata for a while.
I mean, I do think they're a better team with a healthy Agata in there stretching the field than they are with Polito in there coming back to the play and releasing the wingers, because I just don't think the wingers are that dangerous. So I was happy to see Willie. Like, I thought for an hour, Willie was probably the best player on the field for Sporting KC. Then he missed that penalty. Sporting KC's shoulders kind of slumped a little bit, but it was more like they just thought the game was over. And Portland didn't. And Phil Neville made 2 changes at the half, and then another one, brought on Diego Chara at the 55th minute. Penalty was missed at the 60th minute, and it just kicked Portland into gear. They got their own penalty 2 minutes. What did you think of that call, by the way? The Portland penalty in like the 62nd minute.
No, I'm forgetting.
It was on the back post. Oh, I forget.
Oh, yeah, Leibold. Yeah, Leibold. That's a penalty for me. Okay. He's not attempting to win the ball. He's coming through the back of the player. But to your point about Phil Neville, Neville's quotes afterward were like, in the halftime locker room, I was basically telling the guys, like, there might be a few less Portland Timbers around if this is how we're going to play. And I thought what they did was the right thing. They went much more direct. You saw Jonathan Rodriguez move to the wing, where he was very dangerous, created a goal, almost had another one. Felipe Mora, if you get him the ball in the 18-yard box, this dude has showed in MLS he is pretty consistently a decent finisher. And Kansas City did everything you don't want to do. Like, get on the ball, man. Like, don't let them dictate the terms of the game.
And there were no tactical changes, Weeby. Like, I watched it, and like, neither coach changed anything tactically at the hour mark. It was just personnel, and I hate to be this cliche, mentality. Portland's mentality was like, this game's still out there for us to win.
Let's get it. And Peter said afterwards, and I thought this was so telling, he just came out and said it. I told the guys what to do, and they didn't do any of it. Like, we had a game plan for the second half, and they didn't follow it, and we've got to figure out why that happened. I agree with you on Agata, by the way. I just think Daniel Shalvey's not as dynamic as we've seen him in the past. Obviously, Johnny Russell is hurt. I don't know that Eric Tommy is a winger, and like, you know, Alanis Vargas has been pretty good, and you know, they just don't quite have that same, like, hey, these two wingers run it. If we get it to them in good spots, they're going to create goals. And without Gadi Kinda, you don't have somebody who can bring a little bit of a different view to the game, like just a little bit more of a creative presence, a guy who can turn in midfield, unbalanced teams. I like Polito underneath Agata, and it worked against the Galaxy in the first half at home. But then again, another bad second half. So Peter Vermes and Kansas City have something to figure out. That's 2 bad second halves in games that they absolutely should have got dubs in. More whackness. How about San Jose, man?
Not a fan of San Jose. Playing against them, they are playing very dirty football, and I don't think they deserve points ever.
Daniel Shalvey drops in there. Anders was quick. I forgot that was something that we had and could drop into shows, but boy, Anders is quick on the draw here. Daniel Shalvey makes an appearance at San Jose. What's that, 6 losses in 7 games? Is that right?
Let me see.
The numbers don't really matter.
It's 6 losses in 7 games. They've conceded 17 goals, minus 7 goal differential. So they're scoring at least, as they did in this game.
And they're unlucky. You know, when we were talking about goals minus XG, I just went and looked at the opponent numbers, like who's getting the most unfortunate. San Jose are plus 8 non-penalty goals minus expected goals against the model. So 8.6 expected goals overall and 7 non-penalty, plus 8. No other team is within 5
of
that. I
mean, we all chose Daniel in preseason as goalkeeper of the year, and he was a disaster. And then he got hurt, and now they are trying to figure out who their number one goalkeeper is. And it's like the Revs conversation. Like, Daniel was last year, he was at like that Matt Turner, Georgi Petrovic, you know, prime Andre Blake level in terms of shot stopping. And thus far this year, they have had the worst goalkeeping in the league. I actually think that since Nico Chikiris has gotten healthy, gotten into that midfield, I think they're going to keep scoring goals because he puts both wingers Espinoza, who we know is great on one side, and Amal Pellegrino, who has started to round into form.
Let's go.
Like,
let's go.
Chakiris does, like, he's not a pure chance creator, but he gets everybody into position. So I think it's going to work going forward for San Jose. I'm just not sure about it working defensively.
Yeah, work is relative, right? Work is relative.
Neither of these teams are playoff teams.
No.
Neither of these teams are playoff teams as constructed. You could talk yourself into Austin's spine a little bit because I think Driussi and Rubio fit together well. Danny Pereira, really good tempo setter in central midfield, needs to win the ball more. And Brad Stuver hasn't been great this year, but over the past 3-4 years has been the most underrated goalkeeper in MLS. So they're I'm not going to say probably. They might not be a wooden spoon team, but they might be. That's both these teams.
There's a bunch of teams that you could route into that particular fate right now. Two non-playoff teams, at least according to the standings, St. Louis and Dallas. This game did happen. It was 0-0. St. Louis last year, it was Roman Berkey being an absolute stud. He's still mostly doing that. It's just the finishing now that they're not performing to those levels. And I know Anders was yelling about regression in all caps in the chat earlier. There's an element of that here.
There is St. Louis of that. I think St. Louis is actually playing better soccer than they were last year.
They created certainly the opportunities to win this game.
They're just, it's regression to the mean all over. And I think they missed the hell out of Jared Stroud. I think Jared Stroud just said, look, it's not a coincidence that Jared Stroud is starting every game for this DC United team that is overperforming expectations. He's an engine out there at a spot where St. Louis seemed to be missing a little bit of something this year. Because if you look at all those goals that St. Louis were gifted in 2023, Stroud was central to so many of them just because he makes it uncomfortable for every center back, every fullback, every defensive midfield in his zip code. And I'm not sure that the guys that St. Louis have this year in those spots are doing the same amount of kind of buzzing. And so it's just become 3% harder. And that's the difference.
I mean, Klaus had the chances too in this game. Speaking of woodwork hit and opportunities squandered, I do want to shout out Kip Keller, who has fully recovered from the Jared Sprout experience, now in the starting lineup for FC Cincinnati. So just shout out to Kip on that one. In the mailbag, MLS Aces podcast said, we are hitting a point early in the season where we're really understanding what teams are or can be in 24. How can some of the teams lower in the standings plan to begin to fix themselves in the summer window? Speaking of the St. Louis-Dallas game, I would shout out FC Dallas. One, I mean, you can't really control this in a lot of ways. Got to get guys out of the training room. If Jesus Ferreira is not going to play for you, you're not going to win very many games. The other one is go get another center back. Nkosi Tafari, not in the team for this one. And in my opinion, he is by far their best center back, but not in his best moment. But who is in their best moment right now for FC Dallas? That's a big open question. But you got to have Iatamendi on the field. You have to have Tafari in good form. And you got to have Jesus Ferreira getting the ball and creating and scoring as well. What about you? What's a team that could use a little something-something?
I mean, if they could sort of fast forward the Gauss theorem with Yankov, then that would help Montreal a lot. I think they brought Yankov in with the idea that he would be their primary playmaker, their number 10. And he has struggled throughout the entirety of this 6-game trip. I'm not sure how much to read into that. I think he's probably a pretty good player. Starting off your MLS career with 6 straight on the road, that's tough. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens to Montreal over the next 2 months. They've even with the last 3-4 games of this being kind of a disaster, they've put themselves in pretty good spot heading into what'll be a home heavy schedule literally for the rest of the year.
Yeah, like in 6 games on the road, 7 points, 2 wins. I mean, take that every single time if you're Laurent Courtois. Okay, a little bit more to go, and then we'll get you out of here. John Rollins says, hey, we need a Weeby pep talk for the Orlando City fans. I'm not sure I'm here to give you one. We had such high hopes this season, partly due to the media hype. I raise my hand on that one. What would you guys say about what will give us hope that things will improve And then Nothing But Nick hit us up and said in response, I think they'll vote DP production. Facundo Torres especially, but also Luis Muriel, who was brought in to score and we still have not seen it. Yes, that's what I would say. Now, to go back to FC Dallas, I think there's a lot of key pieces in Orlando that are just, they're just not performing at the same level they did last year. Center backs, certainly the goalkeeper, central midfield, and definitely the DPs. So all those other guys got to get up to the level, but man, this is not enough from Facundo for sure and Muriel. And I'm confused at the use of DP spots by the organization and then how it translates to what Oscar Pareja wants to do. Like, they signed Ojeda for a record number. And it's like Oscar just doesn't trust him to be a starter.
Yeah.
And he has the ingredients to do the things that Orlando conceivably needs, which is just to be a little bit more unpredictable and creative in central midfield.
Why is Muriel
playing second striker? And then dropping into the left, he just drops in where Lodero is, where the left, he just drops into that left channel, which is where Ojeda can, that's where he kind of wants to be too. So why not Ojeda?
Yeah, no, like, I co-sign everything there. I think it's beyond time to see Ojeda as a number 10 in a sort of Reynoso style. All right, let's run the whole thing through you, because he's the guy who sees the last pass. Facu Torres has never been the guy who really sees the last pass. He combines, he can be dangerous, but he's not going to run the ship. Nico Lodero used to be that guy, but I don't think he's that level anymore. I think it was a good signing.
Yeah, he's a reserve. He's a good reserve.
The Muriel thing, Weeby, the Muriel thing I get. They thought they were selling Duncan Robinson.
Duncan Robinson. You're
Duncan. They thought they were a different part of Florida there.
They were going to replace the 3-point percentage.
Right. They thought they were going to sell Duncan McGuire. And so they wanted to go out and get a DP number 9. I think that made sense. Now, Muriel hasn't lived up to it, but it's hard to live up to it when nobody on the field is creating chances, which brings it back to, okay, Ojeda has to be out there. All combined in this, injuries, absences with Araujo and Cartagena. So they haven't had the stability. Brocalo hasn't fit quite as snugly, quite as quickly at center back as you had hoped. Dagger Dan has had to come in and play defensive midfield. Kyle Smith has had to come in and play defensive midfield. It's been a mess. If you want the pep talk, it looked terrible this time last year too.
Yeah, this was their issue then as well, right?
Yeah. So I still think they'll be okay. The ceiling is lower than we had all hoped heading into the season. And then the worry is, okay, the East is a buzzsaw. It's just a wood chipper. You know, we didn't even talk about Atlanta in our top five. Atlanta might be a top five team. It's going to be playing catch up the rest of the year. And in order to play catch up, you got to score goals. And that, like, it's time to put Ojeda in a position where he could be the guy who's generating goals for this team.
Ellis Iverson says, what is causing the slow start to the season for Diego Luna? I dug into all the stats and obviously watching the games too, trying to figure this out. He's just not goal dangerous this year at all. Still good assist numbers, still good expected assists and chance creation numbers about in line with what he did over a really good stretch last year. There's zero production or goal dangerous moments from Diego Luna. I'll have to go watch more to see why that is. I mean, I think he has 4 shots so far this year, basically no XG. But I did go look at who scored just to see which side of the field the ball was going down. And based on the anecdotal evidence this weekend, Andres Gomez had a great game and was in a ton of 1v1 opportunities. And that's what created the goal for Chicho Arango. Right now, 44% of attack is coming down the right side, 31% coming down the left. So if you want to best use Diego Luna, I would think that you would want to equalize those just a little bit, because he's not going to be somebody who feasts on Andres Gomez style service from the right side. And you would think with Katranis on the left, who's still integrating, you have somebody to provide width and balance and another player to combine with for Luna. So I'd say give this one time, and also remember that he's a very young player who has a new contract, pressure on him that he maybe has never had before. And he has spoken publicly about dealing with the mental side of the game this year and having some difficulties in that sense. So let's give him a little bit of time. And we end here from Mike with WrestleMania just happening. Any current players you would want to have wrestlers who have the persona for that? Former players, Zlatan, the tag team of Linhart and Gordon with Wando as their manager.
Wait a minute. If we're going to have Zlatan, we got to have Gooch in there as well.
That's true.
That is the headline event. Zlatan versus Gooch.
That's MLS Mania. Right,
a rematch.
There. Yes. I like Wando as the manager for the Linhart Gordon tag team. I think that's a good role for him. I would argue Yakumakis from this crop of players, the Greek god of suplex, maybe. Anybody else sticking out to you?
I mean, Tim Melia was the one who popped into my head first because he literally suplexed, was it Christian Roldan?
I think so, yeah.
Three or four years ago.
And he has the flat top looking, and he also might have the physique.
He's swole.
Yeah, he might have the physique.
Wow.
Yeah, he jacked. How about Ricky Pooge as like the pretty boy that everybody boos?
I mean, he seems a little small for wrestling, but, you know, I'm not a fan, so...
I don't know. And then I feel Vanni Sartini put a microphone in that man's hand and he will have the crowd eating out of it. So that's our take on that. Not big wrestling people, but maybe you have some you can throw at us. Hit us up on Twitter or in the email, extratime@mlssoccer.com. That's it for us. I hope you enjoyed the 80 minutes of wonderful coverage. As promised, a absolutely delightful show, I can report. Doyle, thanks for your time, man. We're out of here. See you on Thursday. Adios.
Go Huskies. We'll be right back.